like I truly love children, so I wouldn't want to hurt them.
Welcome to the Rex Crim Show, PJ.
Hi.
I wonder if, to the level that you're comfortable, you could introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who you are.
Sure. So I'm PJ. I'm 20 years old, and I'm a MAP, and that means minor attracted person. I'm attracted to young boys between the ages of 1 and 12. I don't know, what else would you like to hear?
Yeah, I want to hear all about it. I like to start off by just, getting to know what it is that you're comfortable sharing. I respect, the need for discretion in emails back and forth to each other. You know, clearly you indicated that you're not comfortable, disclosing certain aspects. I think PJ is a pseudonym or an alias. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And obviously, you're not going to be giving us your geolocation or anything like that, which is understandable because much of this conversation is going to be around stigma and, the divergent perspective between popular perceptions of pedophilia and maybe some of the realities that you experience. Could I just get clarity on the preferred terminology that you opt for?
Right. So there are quite a few labels or terms that I use to describe myself. One of them is obviously MAP, but I also like pedophile or BL, and that means boy lover. So.
Mm-hmm. And so you've alluded to your orientation. This is, I think you would agree, and it sounds like an age orientation, and you can discern.
Yes, that's
okay.
Correct.
So specifically males you're attracted to and between the ages of 1 to 12 years in age.
Yeah, I'm non-exclusive, so I can be attracted to older people as well. But it doesn't happen quite often.
Okay, great. Yeah, these are all points that I was hoping to hit on, and you're doing it right off of the onset, so you're making my job easy, PJ. I wonder, without getting too specific, could you share a bit of insight as to the accent that we're hearing or the general area? You're not in the United States, I think.
Yeah, so I'm not a native English speaker. So if I, struggle to make sentences or make some errors, then that's why I'm from Europe.
Okay, very good. Europe, that sounds specific enough. You sound very clear, yeah. and I understand you entirely. So I think we're setting up for an interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Can you tell me about earlier interviews you've given? You'd mentioned contact with graduate students, researchers, previous involvement on a podcast about minor attracted persons.
Right. That podcast was created by a couple of my friends. Three people, actually. Two of them were MAPs, and one of them was an LI, and they did quite a few episodes talking about various issues related to pedophilia and other stuff. Like basically, when I was on as a guest, we talked about Star Wars, and that obviously doesn't have anything to do with pedophilia. So it was quite a diverse podcast in terms of subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
I've helped with various studies and research done by these graduate students. And I'm actually in talks with another one right now. So that's going to be coming up for me.
We talked about in email, this idea of community activism in the minor attracted community, which I want to mm-hmm. delve into in more detail. But I'm trying to paint a picture for listeners, you know, a little bit more of your circumstances. Could you, I mean, you're a person first and foremost, and I think you're identifying with this label of pedophile and minor attracted person or boy lover, as you put it. Could you elaborate on and describe what it was like first realizing this orientation for yourself?
Yeah, of course. I first realized I was attracted to young boys when I was 14. I've come across a website that was basically like an image board that people used to, you know, share and upload pictures of children. It was not a pornography website. It was just, you know, swimsuits and shirtless pictures and stuff like that. Yeah, so basically that's when I realized that I was attracted to those children in the pictures.
Mm-hmm. And that was at the age of 14, so during your adolescence and in puberty?
Yeah, correct.
And
actually, that's quite common for pedophiles. That's one of the most, well, I guess, popular or, I don't know, common age of realization.
Mm-hmm.
So most pedophiles discover that they are attracted to children before they turn 18.
Right. And so how did you respond or react to this realization? I mean, is this something that was just natural and comfortable for you, or has there been some discomfort in negotiating this interpersonally?
Yeah, I think a lot of people struggle with it at first. For me, it was quite a different process. I was curious about it. I wanted to learn more, so I would spend a lot of time reading up on it on Wikipedia and other stuff. So for me, it was... It wasn't really a terrible experience. It was like, oh, you know, I'm attracted to kids. And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
That it's just part of me.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, I mean, when I talk to folks who are in America, in the U.S. specifically, there's, you know, a significant amount of disdain, and it seems like the stigma is even more harsh than other places in the world that maybe are more lenient or tolerant. I'm thinking of Europe. I went to grad school in the Netherlands, in fact, and, you know, that's a place that often... it's celebrated for, you know, their mm-hmm. social policies and tolerance specifically. Can you provide any context about the culture where you grew up and where you lived? Do you think that's played a part?
So you mentioned the Netherlands, and I think that's basically one of the best places to live as a pedophile, because they have all these organizations and the Dutch pedophile community is quite large. They have a website and a chat service called pedophilie.nl, and it's quite large community, but like other parts of Europe are not so lucky.
Mm-hmm.
So basically where I live, it's quite different. There's basically nothing related to non-offending pedophiles.
Mm-hmm. Before I inquire about activism and community involvement, can you shed any more light on who PJ is as a person? You know, I'm trying to humanize this voice that we're hearing. I think people are going to be naturally uncomfortable with the subject matter. I mean, there is a great deal of misunderstandings and myths perhaps about orientation versus action and behavior. And so we're trying to just better understand, you know, who PJ is aside from just their sexual orientation. Can you shed any more light on how you maybe, you know, make your livelihood or generally speaking, you know, what you do in your free time?
I don't want to give out too much, but I'm basically a university student. My hobbies include making digital artworks and basically photo manipulation and compositing. And I like watching films, TV shows, and playing video games.
Okay, right on.
So that's pretty much
just the usual things that a university student might
enjoy. Exactly.
Okay, so I think there's probably some, you know, the elephant in the room here seems to be this idea of community involvement, activism, organization among pedophiles. You alluded to the, having been on an image board, a website, and, you know, while it doesn't sound like explicit forms of child abusive material or pornography, there's some trading of benign images, you know, and so there's ambiguity about, you know, how people might feel on this. Can you clarify what you mean by activism? Help us understand what you mean being involved in community among minor attracted people.
Right. So basically I have two goals that I would like to achieve through activism, and they're interconnected. So one of them is decreasing child sexual abuse, and the other one is obviously making the world a better place for minor attracted people. And for me, activism is about talking to people about my ideas and beliefs, and trying to make them think and understand that the stigmatization of pedophiles is harmful for both children and pedophiles.
Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate further on that? I think people that aren't familiar with the subject matter are probably conflating the idea of child sexual abuse, molestation,
right,
with orientation.
Pedophilia is the sexual attraction to children. It has nothing to do with sexually abusing a child or doing anything. It's a feeling. Most child sexual abuse is not committed by pedophiles. There's actually two types of child sexual abusers. The so-called opportunistic and the preferential. So the preferential would be the one who's attracted to children, and that is part of the reason why they're committing child sexual abuse. And the other one is like they're just opportunistic. They abuse children because they can.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the distinction.
And earlier you alluded to the idea of being non-exclusive. So we could go further into distinguishing, even more of a typology of these. I mean, it doesn't seem a homogeneous and standard stereotypical pedophile per se. There's more diversity among orientation, exclusivity. Could you speak a little bit more about that?
Right, exactly. So we use the term AOA to specify which ages we're attracted to, and that's short for age of attraction. So Basically, every pedophile has a different age of attraction, and it's one of the first questions we ask each other to, you know, get to know each other better. And yeah, so there's also which genders we're attracted to. There are BLs, CLs, and GLs. And also the exclusivity. So if a person is not only attracted to children, but other people as well, then they're non-exclusive. And the degree of exclusivity can vary from person to person as well.
Mm-hmm. Just clarify on, I think you said BS, GS, CS. What are those?
BL, GL, and CL. So boy lover,
girl lover,
child lover, and girl lover. Yeah.
I see. Okay. So that elucidates some of this idea of exclusivity and orientation, which is diverse and different for you and all other folks identifying as minor attracted.
Right.
Okay. Well, so I think the concern that people are that we need to hit off the top here is that, you know, if there's community involvement, organization, I mean, your goals are laudable goals. They're noble ones, you know, decreasing the experiences of child sexual abuse, as well as creating a safer place for minor attracted folks. But what do you say to people, just to play devil's advocate, that call that bogus? And, you know, there's concern of trading in material on these websites. Can you share a little bit more about the advocacy that and you know, creating awareness that goes on, and about the moral standards that minor attracted folks have?
Right. So I understand the concerns that some people might have, but my answer to that would be to, I don't know, join a community, I guess, where that doesn't happen, because there are places like that. So, for example, I moderate a support group for minor attracted people. And that we don't even allow pictures of children of any kind. And we take child sexual abuse very seriously.
Mm-hmm. I mean, arguably, it sounds like, you know, for, say, a child lover, you know, if we can divorce, you know, the idea of sexuality and the idea of contact, arguably someone that truly does love, you know, a youngster or have true love for youth, I can't think of another person, arguably, to preserve, you know, the well-being and safety of those folks. I mean, it sounds
right. Exactly. I completely agree with you. For me, any desire to harm a child is diminished by my desire to protect them from harm. I truly love children, so I wouldn't want to hurt them at all.
Mm-hmm. How do you go about establishing those personal rules and those boundaries? How do you set those moral standards? You've talked about, you know, moderating an online chat, you know, but earlier you also talked about stumbling across an image board. So clearly, you're learning. You're a university student that's still developing and building awareness. Describe the rules and the moral standards that you set personally.
My moral standard would be, if it's harmful, then it's wrong, basically. So that's how I decide whether something is wrong. And obviously, child pornography is harmful, because viewing it creates more demand, and that's why personally I don't view it or indulge in it.
Mm-hmm. But who's to say what is pornography and what is art?
Right. It's a tricky question, but generally, I think like shirtless pictures of children are not pornography.
But I wonder about, you know, how one would respond to those pictures. So now, you know, maybe we're getting too personal, but we're talking about, you know, the idea of masturbation. And this sort of ties into previous episodes in the Rex Crim Show, where I've spoken to folks who struggle with inceldom or the idea of being involuntarily celibate. In your case, you're, you know, describing non-exclusivity. So there's potential or perhaps even a vivacious love life that you have with an adult partner. Can you speak any more about that? How do you navigate this orientation and urges, or, you know, how do you manage that attraction in practice?
Right. I think every map has different boundaries and limits of what they're comfortable with while masturbating or any other way of dealing with their sexuality. It's a gray area with pictures of children, obviously, like would nudist pictures be considered pornography? I mean, if the time they were taken, it wasn't sexual, but to a pedophile, they might be. So,
I guess it's about how you respond to those pictures, and, you know, any associated behavior of those pictures. But then it becomes a little bit more murky in trying to discern, you know, harm. I'm just really interested in when you say if it's harmful, it's wrong. But how does one go about discerning where, you know, what is wrong and what is harmful? I realize this is more abstract than, you know, you can only speak to your own experience. But for example,
right. In terms of child sexual abuse material, there's clearly harm involved because it's a recording of a harmful event done to a child. Viewing that increases the demand to create more. And that's where the harm comes in, I think. Because, like, I think that any kind of sexual act between adults and children is harmful.
So then, to murky the waters a little bit further, then how do you make sense of imagery or fantasies that don't involve actual children, but, you know, for example, cartoons and this sort of thing? Where does that fall into your...
Right. I think cartoons are completely fair play because of the reason that they don't involve any real children. So there's no opportunity for harm there.
Does it become harmful in your mind? You know, earlier you alluded to the idea of viewing material as creating a demand and an appetite for it more. And so I'm wondering how you reconcile this in terms of, you know, cartoons.
Right. But when you're viewing cartoons or drawings, then you're creating demand for more drawings, which is inherently not harmful.
Very interesting. I mean, I think most the popular perceptions would have you believe that, you know, folks who identify with this label of being a pedophile, you know, is inherently tied to, you know, behavior abuse. But actually what we're hearing is a much more nuanced approach. I mean, you're taking one of, arguably a very high moral standard if what you're saying is true, which you have no reason to be dishonest here. If anything, you have more to lose than to gain. So I have every reason to believe that you're the real deal. And so if this is accurate, I mean, we need to be arguably hearing from folks who make a concerted effort to not offend, to not have contact with youngsters, to better explicate ways of fostering that safety.
Absolutely. I think humanizing non-offending pedophiles is essential to creating a better place for everyone.
Can you explain a little bit more of language that you might be privy to in moderating communities online? For example, the difference between offending, non-offending, contact, non-contact or anti-contact. Just elaborate a little bit further, if you can, on these ideas.
All right. So anti-contact is the belief that sexual contact between adults and children is harmful and therefore should not be acted upon. And pro-contact would be the opposite of that. So believing that it is not necessarily harmful inherently, but harm may come from, I don't know, societal attitudes and stuff like that. I'm personally anti-contact, so I believe that it is harmful no matter what. And non-offending, I think that's a pretty clear statement. It's about legality, so a non-offending pedophile would be someone who is not committing a crime.
On the Rex Crim Show, we really contend with stigma and divergent perspectives, and I can't think of a more germane place or a more pertinent topic than this. Some could say that it's offensive just being or identifying in this way. And others might argue that it's a disorder. I wonder if you can share perspective on, any involvement, for example, with the justice system, or can we add more nuance by, indicating whether you've had dealings with people that, that maybe are pro-contact, which would be of concern, or people that have been involved with the justice system and perhaps found ways of reforming and rehabilitating themselves. Help us understand this idea of where the line is or ought to be about, criminality and, just being an authentic individual with an orientation that you don't necessarily choose.
Right. So first of all, I would just like to clarify that a pro-contact does not necessarily mean that they're offending. Pro-contact pedophiles can be non-offending. In fact, many of them are. And I just happen to have a philosophical disagreement with them. And I have been involved with people who have had dealings with the justice system, like ex-offenders, and most of the ones that I've met have understood that it what they did was wrong, and now they're trying to make that right in some way by advocating for child sexual abuse prevention.
Shed a little bit more light on this philosophical disagreement. Obviously, the risk when we're talking about pro-contact, so having non-sexual contact with youngsters, I'm imagining, having kids on your lap and that sort of thing. I mean, obviously the risk of harm is certainly higher in cases where there's, pro contact as opposed to no contact. So can you better explicate this idea of the philosophical disagreement that you mentioned?
I'm not necessarily certain if that's the case. I would like to read up on it, but I don't know. I have not read any studies saying that that's the case. I have heard that spending non-sexual contact with children leads to less legitimizing beliefs towards adult child sex. And right, so I don't know if there's a higher risk involved if one's a pro-contact pedophile. Like, they can have just as many reasons not to offend, for example, being afraid of punishment.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could speak a little bit more about where how you see your particular orientation arriving. You know, where does that taste come from? Do you have any insight as to, you know, whether this is a debate of nature or nurture or a combination of both?
The short answer is I don't know. The long answer is scientific evidence points towards it being an inborn trait. There are studies that links it with less white matter in the brain and other biological conditions, like pedophiles tend to be tend to have a higher chance of being left-handed and short and stuff like that. So there are a lot of biological components that points towards it being, you know, innate.
Are you comfortable sharing a little bit more detail? You know, around the age of 14, you started to realize this in yourself. Could you share any more about your personal experience in arriving at this orientation? Is there, you know, you talk about brain matter, you talk about some of the science, about the biological orientation, but I'm wondering about any involvement as a youngster yourself that might have impacted your view. Is there anything on the nurture side of things that you can explain that might have impacted your perspective?
Well, I was never sexually abused, so I don't know. So I have heard theories that a traumatic event can kind of trigger pedophilia if they're already inclined to it. For instance, in my case, it could be the divorce of my parents, but I have that's just speculation. I have no clue.
Do you lean towards one or the other, or a healthy combination of the both in terms of nature and nurture? Can you weigh in on? I'm correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you're leaning more towards this being an innate biological function and therefore and you know nature as opposed to nurture, or am I wrong?
You're correct. I do think that I was born with it. I don't know if this traumatic experience theory is correct or has any merit, but it would make sense, I guess.
You alluded to studies, and this is something that you're clearly passionate about and spending much time reading on. Can you share any insights about studies that you've found most compelling, or is there areas, is there research that you can point to or suggest people look into?
Yeah, I would recommend the research by James Cantor. He is one of the world's most well-known researchers in the topic of pedophilia. He's the one who discovered the white matter thing and the other biological factors. He has a presentation on YouTube. I don't know if you search for James Cantor 2011 presentation or something like that. He has been in numerous news reports and stuff like that. There's like a 5-minute video about him as well. Mm-hmm. That's basically a summary of his research.
Mm-hmm. I believe that, if I'm not mistaken, I think James Cantor is Canadian or partly Canadian or some of the research.
Yes, I think
I'm also
so,
thinking
yeah.
in preparation of this discussion and other podcast episodes I'll be having with minor attracted folks, I've also come across the work of Michael Seto, which is another researcher mm-hmm. on this topic, also in Canada. Do you have an input being, you know, in somewhere in Europe as to, you know, the prevalence? We talked about this earlier, but is there an indication in your mind where you're seeing people experiencing this more or less, or is it fair to say this is an equally distributed global sort of phenomenon?
I do think it is a global thing. Like, I have experience talking to people from all kinds of places just by being part of the community, from all continents, basically. I have talked mm-hmm. with pedophiles.
One of the things that I'm trying to reconcile, or that I really grapple with, that I wonder if you can shed light on, is this idea on the one hand of, it would seem, sexualizing youngsters, girls in particular. You know, I'm thinking of movies, ad campaigns, you know, forever making youngsters seem older and, dare I say, sexy. Whereas on the flip side, you know, we seem to have this condemnation and the sort of drive or hunger to really punish folks who are, you know, struggling or just experiencing the minor attraction, as you put it. So how do you reconcile or make sense of these sort of media contexts? On the one hand, you know, sexualizing youngsters, and on the other, condemning those who partake in that cultural sort of celebration.
Yeah, I think it's a bit hypocritical, because when people make children more appealing to normal people by you know, making them more look like adults, by, I don't know, wearing makeup and the beauty competitions and stuff like that, that's generally not what pedophiles, in my experience, are attracted to. They appreciate the childhood innocence and their beauty, and their natural state, mm-hmm. so to speak. So when they make them look more like adults, and that's not really what a pedophile likes or is attracted to. There are exceptions, of course, but generally it's like making them appeal more towards people who are attracted to adults, mm-hmm. I think.
You're sort of alluding to, I think, in the States especially, this idea of pageantry, where you're...
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
So following up to this idea, I do you have an opinion from a biological or a cultural and societal perspective, you know, as to whether this is becoming more stigmatized or less stigmatized? For example, having podcasts and movies and conversations about this topic, is it perhaps creating more situations where folks might become minor attracted, or are we just, you know, seeing the prevalence, that the true prevalence as a result of being able to converse on it that otherwise would have been not talked about?
Yeah, I don't think that you can make people attracted to children I think that's a bizarre idea, and I don't understand where that is coming from. And that's similar to the arguments against homosexuality and media about LGBT people, that it makes kids go gay or something. I think that's just stupid.
Mm-hmm. I guess a more refined way of asking that question is, you know, is sexuality evolving with culture and society, or would you say it's more static and constant, and there's just always a diversity among different orientations?
I do think so, yes. I have not seen any evidence pointing towards that pedophilia did not exist in the past. In fact, you know, the Greek situation where they, I don't know, had sexual relationship with young boys and stuff like that. So I don't think it's less or more prevalent than it was before. It's just that more people are willing to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate on this idea of stigma and your experiences with it? I mean, for good reason, it seems, you know, you clearly don't want to be sharing your identity and location. What's at stake here?
Right. So when a pedophile is doxxed or it becomes known that they're attracted to children, then their life could turn upside down. They could be reported to the police and, you know, search their house and stuff like that. And that's a really stressful situation, even if they have done nothing illegal. I think putting them through that is unnecessary and inhumane in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So, and stigma in general causes a lot of stress and anxiety for pedophiles. It's something that is hard to deal with for a lot of folks, and it can create psychosocial difficulties.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, drawing back to your goal in activism here, your goals of wanting to create a safer space for everyone, it seems, you know, having folks maps, you know, that are not stressed and anxious, you know, we would seem to want them to be secure and comfortable, you know, to ensure that they have appropriate boundaries, you know, to mitigate the concern of lapses or, you know, problematic behavior.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we pretty much agree that people, you know, generally abuse other people when they're at the lowest point and have nothing to lose. So that's one of the things that stigma causes, depression, anxiety, and loneliness. And that can make it more likely for people to do something harmful, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like child sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, harm themselves, like committing suicide.
Mm-hmm. Are you comfortable sharing? Is there any anecdotes that come to mind or stories that you can share in sort of driving this idea home of what it is like to experience stigma? For example, you know, have you, aside from speaking with a complete stranger like myself or researchers or other members in communities online, who do you share this with in your personal life?
I have come out to a couple of people, for example, my mom, and a few of my friends, and they were generally not negative experiences. they were quite supportive. But I have heard, you know, more negative or sad stories where it didn't go so well. For example, if a pedophile is going to therapy and they come out, they can be reported depending on the laws of the area that they're living in. Like there are lots of countries and areas have mandatory reporting laws when the therapist thinks that there's a potential of danger, and obviously that's up to their subjective assessment.
Clearly, there's more pressure and concern, you know, in depending, as we mentioned earlier, on, you know, where you're living in the world and what the climate of that culture is like. You know, I think there seems to be this increased focus on risk and, you know, concern about risk. And with that comes the assessment and evaluation through quantitative and calculable measures. But really what you and I are talking about is something that's far less tangible. It's much more subjective. Earlier you alluded to the idea of, I think you said psychosocial and some of the distress that might come with you know, learning interpersonally about oneself, especially when you recognize the negative consequences and the potential harm that comes, you know, with just being yourself. How do you exercise, you know, that distress if it's something that you've experienced? You know, is there something to be said about therapy in this and, you know, working through this distress?
Yeah, a lot of pedophiles can't afford therapy or don't have access to a safe therapist. So for a huge number of them, it's not an option, and for me that's the case as well. But there are other options, for example, peer support, talking to other pedophiles, sharing the issues that you're going through. It can be very helpful.
Can you help to dispel any myths that might be floating around for people? You know, I'm thinking of popular television shows coming out of the UK or the US, like To Catch a Predator, or I think there's one called Pedophile Hunter. Help us understand, you know, what that means to you, and are these things that you're familiar with?
Yeah, I have heard of them. I don't know how useful or beneficial they are. I mean, basically, they're creating a situation where they're posing as a young person, and they arrange a meeting, basically, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I don't know, that's like kind of creating a problem instead of solving one. It's reactive instead of preventative. I think we should focus more on dealing with the issues that might lead to people abusing children, mm-hmm. rather than punishing them.
Yeah, it seems to me like, you know, with my background being in criminology and understanding, you know, how societies respond to unwanted behavior, et cetera. It seems to me that, you know, this idea of punishing, as you say, is part and parcel to wanting to reinstate the moral majority. You know, it's easy to point the finger and say maps are different, or that they're, you know, wrong, that they're another, because it reaffirms for folks who are doing that, you know, that they are on the right side of, you know, the moral majority, as it were. It seems to me that a more productive conversation is being able to humanize and, you know, realize that we're actually all very much alike. And that creating a space like this one to have meaningful conversations is what will lend itself to avoiding, you know, abusive situations.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think, humanizing pedophiles and making sure that their mental health is, you know, not in a bad state, is going to decrease child sexual abuse somewhat, at least.
Mm-hmm. How do you keep healthy?
Yeah, I just, you know, talk to pedophiles on the internet. That's basically it. It does help because I can talk about problems that other people might not understand, and they can relate to them in a way that non-pedophiles wouldn't be able to, and it's quite helpful mm-hmm. for me.
Mm-hmm. You're obviously very selective about who you share your personal experience with.
Oh yeah, for sure. It's something that pedophiles have to deal with constantly. And it's, you know, quite a worry for a lot of people because you never know what, you never know if the person you're talking to is telling the truth. So it's difficult to balance that, how much mm-hmm. personal information you want to tell. And stuff like that.
I'm wondering about, you know, the idea of an orientation versus a disorder. You know, obviously, if we're talking about, you know, pedophilia, this is referring to a condition that's been, you know, clinically categorized within the diagnostic and statistical manual of the DSM. Whereas,
right, if we open up the DSM. There's a clear distinction between a pedophilic disorder and a pedophilic sexual orientation or interest. The former would be the psychosocial difficulties that come from pedophilia, but lacking these would just mean pedophilic sexual orientation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, but for you, you know, referring to yourself as using the term pedophile in itself, there's a nuance or something to be distinguished between, you know, the clinical observations and the interest versus, you know, being one, you know, having this, taking on this label or this identity. We seem to be living in a time where, you know, people are more polarized, and much of that has to do with the identity politics. But in your case, when I would assume folks would want to distance themselves from that label, you know, and use a softer term like minor attracted, I think you're quite comfortable identifying as a pedophile, you know, in its own right. What are your thoughts?
I don't think minor attracted person is necessarily a softer term or something to sugarcoat pedophilia. And that's one of the most prevalent critiques or arguments against it. But it's actually an umbrella term that was created by a child sexual abuse prevention organization. It is not synonymous with pedophile. It encompasses several different chronophilias related to attraction to minors, namely pedophilia, nepiophilia, hebephilia, and ephebophilia. So it's like every pedophile is a map, but not every map is a pedophile situation.
Right. So help just unfold all of these terms: mapophilia, hebephilia. You mentioned two others.
Yeah. So nepiophilia is the attraction to infants or toddlers. Some people differentiate between infantophilia, which would be just the attraction to infants, because infants are significantly different than, well, I guess not significantly, but quite a bit different from toddlers. Pedophilia is the attraction to prepubescent children, so children who had not reached puberty. Habophilia is the attraction to pubescent children, so minors who are going through puberty. And ephebophilia is the attraction to postpubescent minors.
Mm-hmm. So even more, discernment among, referring back to the category, the age category. Where do these terms come from? Are they something that you would find within the DSM, or are they something that you've come across in your circles?
I think only pedophilia would be in the DSM. I'm not sure, maybe even habophilia, the other two, I'm not sure. These are scientifically accepted and used terms. I'm pretty sure Michael Cito even used them. Mm-hmm. I think he's the one who coined the term chronophilia, which is the attraction related to age. He proposed the idea of sexuality being a spectrum with two axes, one of them being gender and the other age. Mm.
And so now, having distinguished these different terms, and earlier you disclosed your own orientation, which is the most appropriate? What do you think, now that we're getting technical, is the most appropriate? Is still pedophile or pedophilia the most appropriate in describing your interest?
I would say I'm predominantly a pedophile and a nepiophile.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, this is all just so fascinating and interesting, and I think I wonder what advice you can give to folks who are interested in learning more, or perhaps struggling. And in your work as an advocate, this is an opportunity for you to plug and to share this message of abstinence from contact. What more is there for you to say? What can you plug?
Yeah, I would recommend joining a MAP community if you're a MAP who's struggling with their feelings. I moderate a chat called MAP Support Club, and that's mapsupport.club if you're typing that in your browser. We also have a non-MAP channel. So if you're just interested in learning more about pedophiles and MAPs and stuff like that, then that would be the option for you.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of other podcasts that I've come across in preparing for our chat. I'm wondering if you're familiar at all with the Prevention Podcast.
Yeah, I am. I have listened to quite a few episodes myself. It's created by an organization that I have a very high opinion of, and I think they're doing wonderful work.
I think I'll link that in the show notes. And I wonder if there's anything else you think is important to include for.
There was another podcast that was created by a few MAPs called MAPs IRL. It used to be on YouTube, but it has been taken down. You can find it in various places if you look for it on Google. It's pretty much my favorite MAP-related media, and it's fascinating, and I was always so excited when a new episode came out.
That's called Maps IRL.
Yeah. In real life.
Oh, I see. In real life. Very good. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We'll have to see if we can find these and put those, check out the show notes for that mapsupport.club prevention podcast, Maps in Real Life. Well, I wonder what more there is to be said. Do you have anything? I mean, we've covered so much in such little time. I'm racking my brain trying to make sense of all this, and I wonder if there's things that you think we should have covered. What else do you think is important for folks interested in this topic to know about?
Oh, I should have prepared for this. I don't know. I think an interesting topic that rarely gets talked about is the issue of auto-pedophilia, which is when someone is sexually turned on by the thought of imagining oneself as a child. And in my experience, a lot of pedophiles also have auto-pedophilia, which is quite interesting, I think.
So that the idea of you're saying auto-pedophilia is as in autobiography, like you're imagining yourself as a youngster and what it would be like to relive that.
Right.
Yeah, it reminds me of something I've heard on other that I've seen in preparing and listened to in the prevention podcast, this idea of arrested development. And it, you know, it refers back to what I was asking you about to nature and nurture specifically. I've heard other maps describe, you know, an instance in their life maybe that has stunted their development. It's arrested their development, and thereby explaining, you know, why it is that their orientation might be focused in a particular area. What is your take on this idea of arrested development?
Right. Actually, one of James Cantor's findings was that a lot of pedophiles seem to have suffered head trauma. And for me, I can recall an event where I fell off the bike and hit my head. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, so that could be true, but I don't know if that's truly the case. Mm-hmm. It's just speculation. Like, it could be the one glass of water I drank one morning that caused my pedophilia.
You don't really know. And frankly, there isn't much known about, you know, there's much more that's not known about than known about this subject. So those speculations, that sort of visceral experience and those anecdotes, I think are useful in better making sense of.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. We need to have more research on pedophilia in general.
What is your opinion of female and women pedophiles?
I think they're quite cool. it is true that the majority of pedophiles are male, but I have spoken to quite a few female pedophiles as well. And I don't know if it's just because of the stigma and they're not willing to talk about it as much as males, or it's truly something that's predominantly occurs in males. Male pedophiles seem to be more common, but it does happen with females as well.
Yeah, it makes me wonder about about this idea again of societal expectations and culture, because, you know, by and large, the opinion, it seems, is that perpetrators of crime or, you know, offending behavior are by and large males anyway. And so it seems like, women are sort of, dare I say, have maybe a well, I don't know if that's fair at all to say they have an easier way of navigating. You know, I think the expectation is that they can't commit crimes. You know, they're seen as nurturing. Yeah, help me bring some clarity to this idea.
Yeah, I think so. So the stereotypical pedophiles are generally male and you know, fat old men with a trench coat. So it has a lot to do with societal attitudes and opinions and beliefs. You know, I have mentioned that most pedophiles discover their attractions around the age of 14. So that alone kind of disproves that stereotype.
Can you share more on your opinion of popular perceptions and stereotypes and examples that you've seen in popular media? I'm thinking of characters like, you know, the Herbert, who's clearly a pedophile, and Family Guy, if you're familiar, or just, you know, a whole variety of characters and icons that sort of pop up every so often in TV shows and movies. You know, what more can you say about the stereotypical idea of what a pedophile is or is not?
I think it's quite funny, actually. I don't find it offensive or anything. I think it's it can be done in a clever way. One of the stereotypes, I guess, is that we have urges to have sexual contact with children. And I think that's not the case at all. For me, I have no such urges. I have urges to eat, to sleep, but I have never been tempted to act sexually against a child. It would be... it would take effort, and you know, it's not something that happens accidentally. Mm-hmm. It's usually planned.
Mm. Well, I'm just so grateful to have you know, shared this this, you know, highly exclusive insight. I think you know, the vast majority of time we're hearing from people in your position, they're folks that have succumbed to those urges, that have reacted instead of responded, and that have been, you know, known to the justice system because of their misdeeds. So, you know, I think it's commendable, and there's a level of courage to be recognized here in you, you know, bravely coming on and sharing some of this insight, as uncomfortable as it might be for you and for folks that have tuned in. So thank you for taking the time. I want to give you the last word, and I wonder if you can, you know, shed light on, aside from the auto pedophile, or perhaps hearing from a female pedophile, who you think I should be connecting with to have on this show, or you know, what it is that you look forward to in the future going forward.
Oh, I think you're free to join Map Support Club if you want to meet other pedophiles and look for people who are willing to come on your podcast. Or you could also try Virtuous Pedophiles, and that's verped.org. I think there are quite a few people there also who would like to be on your podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Or just talk to you in general.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in divergent perspectives, and this is obviously an area that's highly divisive for folks. But I think there's quite a bit that can be learned. We'll be in touch. I'd be, very interested in hearing any other resources for folks that you encourage, who might be struggling. I'm thinking also of one that I've come across known as, Before You Act.
I just wanted to say that as well. Before You Act is a wonderful resource.
Describe.
And they also have these workshops that they do. It's like a community event, and a lot of maps and researchers come together and, do stuff. I don't know what happens, but it's something that fascinated me, and I would like to go there one day, but unfortunately I can't right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a resource that I've heard of and people speak highly of. I think there's research that's going on, and I think it's out of Germany, but maybe I'm mistaken.
Before You Act, I think it's in the U.S.
Oh, is it? Okay.
There's a German thing called Prevention Project Dunkelfeld.
That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah, that's another one. Okay, good.
It's another one.
Yeah, well, this is important, I think, important work that folks have an outlet and a means to think and become mindful before they act in a way that can hurt others. So this is about preventing crime and understanding it. And so I'm entirely grateful for you taking the time and speaking with me. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.